You've got to listen to this.
Today, Indiana Governor and right-wing evangelical Christian Mike Pence signed into law the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This bill basically allows anyone of any religion to make certain decisions based on religious beliefs. This comes on the heels of that case in Oregon where a bakery cited religious beliefs as their reason for refusing to sell a wedding cake to a lesbian couple. The bakery, run by a husband and wife team, was fined back in February for $150,000. You can guess they're probably going to move to Indiana. With the Religious Freedom Restoration Act signed into law, this goes beyond refusing to sell cakes. Religious freedom is important. You should be able to practice whatever religion you're affiliated with freely and openly. But you should also be aware of the big difference between citing religion for not eating a certain type of meat versus refusing service to and or discriminating against an entire group of people. And where exactly do you draw the line? It's absolutely insane. The last few years alone, we've made a lot of progress in LGBTQ rights, and the right-wingers keep going way out of their way to push back and find any reason or way to destroy these rights. Oklahoma went as far as to introduce a bill to do away with issuing state marriage licenses altogether. Like, really? You hate gays that much that you'd rather do away with marriage altogether than deal with the fact that times have changed and you are still a horrible human being. Back to Indiana. As I said, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act goes way beyond refusing to sell baked goods. According to freedomin.org, that is short for Freedom Indiana, the bill will cause real harm, and not for just LGBTQ folks. In a post on their website, they note, for children and child abuse, RFRA could be used to roll back protections for children at child care ministries, including the requirement that anyone who interacts with a child must pass a state background check. For victims of domestic violence, RFRA could allow an abuser to claim certain domestic violence laws don't apply because of a religious belief that someone has the right to discipline their spouse and children as they see it. For public safety, RFRA could allow a police officer to refuse to defend a mosque or synagogue by saying it goes against his or her beliefs. And for us LGBTQ folks, RFRA could be used to ignore laws in 12 regions in Indiana, including Indianapolis, protecting LGBTQ people from discrimination. One example would be a high school counselor could deny help to a gay student. So what can be done? Boycotting anything from Indiana or going to Indiana is a small, small start. I would hope activists take a cue from Ferguson and protest loud and strong and make sure that you're heard. I guess separating church from state isn't a thing anymore. For the Biggs Beat on Flashpoints, this has been Mike Biggs.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 11:02 a.m. That was Flashpoints. Thank you to our good friends and our siblings in struggle at KPFA in Berkeley for providing that. And thank you to you, KBOO members, for your support for community radio. If that's not you yet, you can remedy that at kboo.fm. You click where it says donate today. Coming up next, Jacob Rubin joins KBOO's own Francis Fagan to discuss his debut novel, The Poser, in which is a strange and delightful comic novel that, at its heart, speaks to the power of performance, impersonation, acting, and what it means to find the essence of someone and of yourself. Let's take a listen.
Yo, Vaughn. Dave Hollister. Oh, hey. Yo, MVP, where y'all at?
Yeah! When you think about me, I'm just wondering how I need.
Hi, I'm Francis Fagan. This is for Radio Zine on KBOO Radio, and I'm speaking with Jason Rubin. Jacob Rubin. Sorry. Okay. Jacob Rubin, who is joining us in the studio today. Thank you so much for coming in, Jacob.
Thanks so much for having me.
And so you just finished your first book, The Poser, and an author is kind of one of the many hats, kind of performative, creative hats you've worn in your lifetime. So maybe, and I know that you began as a musician and as a rapper, and then went through a stand-up career, and then you're a writer now. And what do you think, in the book, the protagonist mentions a thread that goes through a character's life, and the kind of the central element in a person's lifetime. Can you speak to the thread of this kind of act of performance that's gone through your life?
I definitely have performed in different sort of capacities through the course of my life. I was a rapper, as you say, in a hip hop group for about 5 years, and rapped before and after that, but was sort of doing it consistently for that time. And then my sort of forays into stand-up, my foray into stand-up comedy was something that I did for about, it was like 8 months that I did it very intensely and enjoyed it. But it was, and I think sometimes of returning to it, but I think, and the book is about a performer, this impressionist. So I think I've always been drawn to the sort of the idea of personae and masks and the ways in which in performing you're sort of lying, but you're also telling the truth, or the you know, Picasso's famous line about art being a lie that tells the truth. I think that's very true of different forms of performance. And there are certain things you can sort of only say on stage or in an audience because it's in quotation marks, as it were, or it's pretend. And I think a similar thing is in operation with a joke. You know, you can say these really morbid, frightening things because you're saying, oh, don't worry, it's a joke. You know, as long as we all agree this is a joke, now I can sort of open up this release valve and say things that are maybe offensive or strange that I wouldn't be able to say in polite conversation or something.
Like, there's a degree of separation inherent in the act of performance that's kind of, I'm just here presenting this idea, but we're all just simply observing it together.
Absolutely, yeah, which I think is true in fiction, too. It's, you know, a novel's a really strange sort of object because, you know, we're both adults, but it's like, okay, I'm going to pretend this is real for the next week or the next few days or whatever it is when I read this book, and I'm going to sort of make it real for myself, even though I know this is all someone else who's also a sane adult, well, maybe not, but has made this up, and we're both going to pretend it's real. So I think there's that separation there too.
Now, the book itself is so well crafted, really. There's particular lines that are especially polished. I'll mention some of them later in the interview, but it's definitely the work of someone that's been kind of crafting this delivery for much of their life, and the ability to kind of shape these words. And I know that you studied at Harvard, and I also have read some of your work from those times, and there was an interesting story that you wrote that was kind of a timeline of one of your performances with your group, and you went through kind of the evolution of the evening as a hip-hop artist, with your including the ending with your parents in the room all congratulating each other. But even that delivery seemed like you were kind of polishing the stone. Do you feel that this the act of language itself and the way it's expressed has been kind of central in your life?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, thank you. I'm impressed that you found that.
Oh, I'm a sleuth.
Yes, sure. Yeah. That's I mean, I think I got into writing for the language. You know, I had a teacher who used to say that writers were like winos, but with words, you know. So I've always been a fool for language. And I think in my head, because I've always had a propensity to speak and to, I think, use and enjoy metaphor, you then at a certain point realize, well, if I want to do this, I have to, I can't be self-indulgent, so I have to be a little ruthless with myself and how I use this language. You know, I think it's sort of this great tool we have that we can, metaphor is really this magical property where you can alter what something is just by describing it, but it's almost like the Spider-Man thing, with great power comes great responsibility or something.
Yeah.
So you know, if you misuse it, it just becomes silly or frivolous or inaccurate. So I think I definitely became a bit obsessive about polishing and really sort of interrogating each word and making sure it was the right word as best as I could, and that it was doing, you know, its work in the sentence as much as it could.
The idea of a metaphor kind of transforming an object. In your story, there's a lot of discussion about transference of personality. The character is an impersonator that kind of gives his life over to the impressions of others at the expense of, it seems like, developing an awareness of himself. And it seems like a metaphor is kind of a continuation of this idea that the object becomes something much greater or much more diminished by association, right? So the character can become an invisible man or a, you know, a womanizer.
Mm-hmm.
Or
That's very interesting. Yeah, it's a sort of, I guess you could, metaphor as a kind of mimicry in its way. It's a chameleon-like kind of thing because you're altering something, definitely. And I know that metaphor too, I think the word itself actually comes from also the word for like translation, you know, which is a similar property. Yeah, I also am interested in, and I think this maybe comes through in what you're saying about the transference of identity. I really like similes and metaphors that connect two things that seem totally disparate and unrelated. And I think that's sort of when he's imitating people and he's looking for what he calls the thread, which is sort of the way into copying them and finding their essence. You know, it's often counterintuitive. It's not what you would expect. And I think some of my favorite, you know, turns of phrase that I've read in other books sort of jar your consciousness a little bit because, you know, you would never think to compare those two things. But then you realize there is something deep in the unconscious that does connect them, you know. So
this idea of kind of an unexpected connection makes me think of, I was reading in when you were the character in this book, Bernini, who's really interesting. You mentioned that you had actually begun a different short story in that a man wakes up after a one-night stand and that he's looking through the woman's trash to kind of find out more about her, and he pulls out an image that's a photograph of a famous impressionist, and that element was so singular that you abandoned the story and then began this one.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit about kind of this allowing unexpected influences into your work and the value of that, maybe?
Definitely, yeah. I, you know, my writing process is often a line I like that another writer has said is that you just follow your characters around and wait for them to do something interesting, which I think is sort of, I didn't quite know that that's what I was doing, but I was working on that short story. I was sort of following this character around as rummaging through the trash, and then I sort of found this thing that actually interested me. And then I was sentenced to following him around for more time than I'd care to say, you know, in making this book. So I think you definitely have to be open to the unexpected. I think otherwise fiction becomes almost like a thesis paper, which you never want it to be. And sometimes you can, you know, in a way, I think on a certain level, you could probably look at my novel and say, oh, well, it's a very simplistic, obvious theme or something. One of them is identity, but I really wrote it in a way where I was just following this character around and the theme that sort of emerged. So I think you have to write sort of from the inside of seeing where these people want to go, who they are, and let the themes sort of fall where they may or whatever. But I think if you write, at least for me, with some very rigid schema in mind, whether thematically or just for the plot in terms of, okay, on page 20, this is going to happen, it'll feel very lifeless on the page. You know, another maxim I know a lot of writing teachers use is no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. Mm-hmm. So you sort of have to be surprised by it as you're writing if you want a reader to be surprised by it.
Do you think that this freedom as you gain popularity and fame and you take on larger projects or whatever, do you feel like this freedom may be limited by a need to kind of put out successful work? Do you think that that's a, you know, as a performer or as a comedian or whatever route you take, do you think that the need to get, you know, butts in the seats will kind of threaten this creativity?
Mm. You mean generally speaking or for me?
Just in general.
Okay, because I would welcome that problem now.
Well, I guess obviously in general, but maybe for you in particular.
Yeah, well, so far, you know, I can definitely handle the level of fame and popularity I'm at now. It's not too, I don't know how existent it is at all, so I'm happy for whatever attention it gets. I definitely think, you know, I see it with artists I've admired where I think they, you know, if you do reach a certain level of like colossal success,
mm-hmm.
I think it can be paralyzing. I know like Bob Dylan has talked in interviews about how it affected, you know, he used to be sort of the guy in the corner watching everything. And then when he became the object of everyone's gaze, he could no longer be that sort of quiet fly on the wall observer. So I think it can affect you that way. And I do think, as you're saying, probably you start, you know, if you're worried too much about what people expect of you, what they want, you know, then I think it would be very hard to listen to whatever that voice is or follow it all the way, you know. But
and this kind of the idea of the impersonator as a character, as you know, you would there be a point where you're just impersonating what the audience expects?
Definitely. I mean, I think you can, you know, I think some people, yeah, it's, you know, I think in seeing how some people have responded to the book, I could see how there's a certain tack you could take where you think, okay, people seem to like this, so I'm going to do more of that. Or, you know, they didn't seem to like this as much, so I'm not going to do that. Or, but I think probably in the end, you have so little control over what you end up writing. At least it feels that way for me. You know, mm-hmm. I was recently talking to a friend, and I said that writing sometimes felt like trying to break and tame a seal and then ride it like a horse or something. So it's in the end, you have so little control over where the thing wants to go that for me, it would be sort of a fool's errand to try to exert too much authority over it and say, we're doing this, we're going this way, you know, because it has a way of sort of bucking and rebelling.
So the writer as a wild animal tamer?
Exactly, yes, yeah. and a failed wild animal tamer.
So let's speak a little more specifically about the book and about the character in here. How would you describe the main character?
So Giovanni Bernini is he's this kid who's born with the compulsion and the ability to imitate anyone he meets, and as a child he can't really control it. And then as he gets older, he tries to, and he's always looking for, as we were saying earlier, what he calls this thread in other people, to try to, see the essence of who they are and to capture it. And then he ends up sort of, he's a pariah, he's an outsider. And then as he gets older, he becomes actually famous, and so the very thing that sort of excluded him is now what makes him celebrated. And then he sort of has all kinds of, he then gets into politics, and so it was a little bit about how far I think someone born with that kind of gift could actually go in a world similar to ours, but you know, sort of a shadowy version of our of mm-hmm. our country and our world.
It seems too that in throughout the story, the guy Giovanni initially began kind of reflecting people as they were, and then became kind of the person people wanted to see. So there was this transition from representing a specific character to kind of representing an ideal.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like what does that say about politics? Because the character becomes kind of a politician.
Mm. Yeah, well, you know, when I was working on The Poser, I thought a lot about, I read quite a bit about Ronald Reagan, and I just think it's this unacknowledged, crazy thing that this guy who was an actor became not only president, but I think in many ways sort of the model in many Americans' minds of what a president should look and sound like. And it still sort of boggles my mind. I just find it fascinating that this person is an actor, because he was a great actor. You know, he's a great political actor, and was able to sell a certain vision of what, you know, like an actor in a commercial. And so in a way, it's sort of the most far out part of the book, maybe, when he becomes, this character Giovanni Bernini becomes a politician. But in many ways, it seemed like the most realistic in a way, given, you know, what's happened in our country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. I saw a picture of Ronald Reagan as a young schoolboy, actually, yesterday. Mm. And he was wearing a football jersey and smiling.
Mm.
And definitely the representation of American boyhood, mm. you know, safe American boyhood.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think he embodied that for so many, at different phases of his life, embodied for many what, you know, whatever that means, whatever an American quote unquote should be, he sort of captured it for so many people.
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, you've had kind of a varied life as far as the kind of work that you do. And I remember a few years ago, I was sitting in an artist talk with this performance artist, sound engineer, Ronnie Bass, and he had done a sculpture and it had made a film, and someone asked him if he identified as a sound engineer or a sculptor, and he said, which was kind of striking to me at the time, that it was none of those really, that these were all kind of tools that he used to kind of ask a question.
Mm.
And looking over your work and your history, mm. I feel like that's kind of the same element in your writing for Harvard, and then in your, you know, performance as a musician and rapper, and then, you know, you mentioned earlier that you're all, it's crafting language that's mm-hmm. that act of it, right? And then kind of a performative aspect of presenting that. So can you speak of that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that answer he gave was a great one. I mean, that's I think for me, it's all rooted in sort of this verbal propensity that I have, and a sort of verbal orientation. And I really like to listen to people and hear how they use language. I really like to talk to people using my own language. And, you know, I tend to, when I get sick, it's often in my throat. When I have tension, I carry it in my throat. So I think I'm just a very throat oriented, and whether it's sort of vocally singing, and when I read, I like voice driven novels and stories and essays where it's a really the way language is used is strong. When I listen to music, I really like opera. I like rap because I think it's, you know, they're celebrations of the variety of sort of the human voice, and I just like the pathos and the immediacy of hearing a voice. So I think for me, that's probably where it's all rooted, and then it finds these different avenues of expression. But, you know, it could be writing. But for me, it really starts with speaking, I think, and or with music, it's a similar thing. Or even, you know, the stand-up, when I would do that, it's about, you know, when you watch a lot of stand-up comedians, it's even the way they pause, or it's all, you know, a big thing a lot of them do is they stutter, like Letterman and Carson and Woody Allen, they all have this way of stuttering to, I feel like, measure the, when the punchline should come. And it's all, you know, verbal and vocal, you know.
So you're promoting this book, The Poser, and for anyone just joining us, I'm speaking with Jacob Rubin, who just wrote a great novel called The Poser. It's your first novel.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday night you mentioned that you spoke at Hawthorne, mm-hmm. the Hawthorne Pals.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel that going on this book tour, it must in some way just be another series of performances, right? So what's interesting that you're discovering in this specific tour?
Yes, no, that's a very good question. It's fun actually for me in one way, because it is sort of a series of performances, and I do like performing. So, and as a writer, it's a very lonely kind of performance a lot of the time. So it's very gratifying to, you know, be here and talk to someone who's read and thought a lot about the book, you know, or to go to Pals last night and see some old friends who are here, and also, you know, just new people who were interested in the book and had some questions about it. So it's a little strange because, you know, the book is imaginary and has been imaginary for me forever. So it often feels like introducing the world to your imaginary friend or something, and they start talking about it, and I want to say, like, well, how do you know about that? You know, like, that's who told you that? You know,
so only I can see him.
Yeah, that's, you can't see him. What are you talking about? So, but I think it's healthy for me because it's helping me let go of it a little bit and accept that it's I'm no longer the sole proprietor of it. So
you've had the baby.
I've had the baby. Yeah.
So let me. I marked off some really interesting, some sentences or kind of turns of phrase that were really interesting.
Okay.
To me. What was the most surprising thing that you found in writing this book? The most kind of unexpected thing?
That's a good question. I think maybe that it ended with all this stuff about psychoanalysis. I wasn't really expecting, but then I found that I was very interested in writing it.
Well, so it's in your blood, right? Don't you have a couple relatives that are analysts? Yeah,
yes, it's deep in my blood. I come from a family. My father, my aunt, uncle, and grandfather are all shrinks. So yeah, it's deep. It's deep in there. So I shouldn't have been surprised. Yeah.
Do you think that this was kind of a way, because it was so almost ephemeral, and that it is impressions of life, that it allowed you to kind of like muck around a little bit in your subconscious yourself, or not?
No, I think so. I mean, I think all that stuff ends up getting in there that, you know, you didn't necessarily know would.
So you mentioned in here, you say every business, when a character says, so every business is show business. Every business these days is show business. Do you think that this kind of idea of performance really penetrates our life now?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, I think growing up, I'm 33, so I, you know, the 90s and the, I just think everything is so, I mean, well, you see it today in Facebook and that every, you know, everyone now is sort of prosecuting their brand of themselves And that's, you know, and they often mistake it for themselves, but it's not. But they, you know, and I fear sometimes for, maybe I'm just a crotchety older person now, but I, you know, I fear for some of these younger people who are at risk of mistaking whatever sort of argument they make about who they are online or something for who they actually are. And that's just one example of something I think we've been doing for decades now, you know.
But now we have kind of access to this projected representation of ourselves. And you mm-hmm. mentioned branding. And I think that's really interesting because it is a marketing tool. And I don't know if it has something to do with populations, you know, just the numbers increasing, so you have to holler louder to be noticed or whatever, or the just the availability of documentation materials via Facebook or your, you know, smartphones and everything. But it seems like this idea of impersonation and I, you know, identifying with a larger world or idea is increasing. Now you live in Manhattan right now. And I'm interested in how this maybe translates into the culture of Manhattan, mm-hmm. or maybe into the culture that you are mostly in Manhattan.
Mm. Well, I think Manhattan, definitely there's and I think I drew on a little bit, some of that in the book when Giovanni goes to the city and he's at first sort of overwhelmed by the stimulus. And then he realizes there's this kind of face a lot of people use there to sort of as armor almost to not be affected by everything around them. You know, I'm always, the whole idea of homeless people in Manhattan is I just always find very interesting that you're on the subway and here's this person who's sort of dying in front of you. And, you know, you're sort of